Hi guys, welcome to yet another episode of Stoic Talks. Today we have with us Rajiv Thakkar, CIO and Director at PPFAS Asset Management. Now, Rajiv has been an investment banker, started in 1994, moved on to fixed income in late 90s, then to equities in 2003. And while he has shown a perfect timing in his career, his approach to investing is just the opposite. A CA, a cost accountant, and a CFA charter holder, and most importantly, a man who has been entrusted by many in our country to manage their hard-earned money. It's a great privilege to have Rajiv today. This is my second conversation with him. One I recorded long back for Stoic Talks in 2016. And for you, the listener, it is I would highly recommend to go back and check that talk because there were a lot of nuggets in that. And I have tried to build over in this particular conversation with him. So I'm probably going to avoid repeating a lot of questions. So a combination of that with this particular discussion with Rajiv would be very, very beneficial to all the listeners. With that, let's tune in. So Rajiv, thank you for speaking to us. Welcome to Stoic Talks. The last time we interacted was in 2016 for a similar kind of a podcast. And I sense a lot of change for PPFAS, especially during that time because of the scale and size you have achieved. And a lot would have remained similar also. You were at that time a recent entrant into the mutual fund space, I think shifting from a PMS to a mutual fund. And you discussed in detail the reasons for that in the previous discussion because of scalability and all that kind of stuff. So I thought it would be a good time to just run through this journey that has been since you have entered mutual fund space, how things have evolved for you. And when we last, you know, I remember there was a discussion on your perfect timing of your career, that you've timed your career very well, right? You went from investment banking to bonds in late 90s and then early 2000, I think 2003, if I'm not wrong, you went into equities. It's ironical that you don't do timing of the market as well as you time your career. But how has this journey been for you the last 8 years since we communicated or from the time you have entered the mutual fund space? When I say journey, evolution in terms of markets or yourself or your investment philosophy or any such thing which you have changed or evolved into?
Sure. I think largely the change has been, as you referred to, the scale, the number of clients, the size of the assets that we manage. The investment approach is more or less the same. I don't see that as having changed too much. The reasons actually panned out, the reasons to shift from a PMS structure to a fund structure. One is the accessibility of the PMS structure itself has gone down for investors over the years. So when I started out in 2003 managing PMS funds, at that time we were having the access limit at 5 lakh per client. That was increased to 25 lakhs and today it's at 50 lakhs. So bulk of investors don't have that option of availing PMS services. That was one reason to come to the fund structure. The other thing was that despite all the simplification attempts over the years, end of the day, for PMS, you require a new bank account, you require a new DMAT account, you require a custody agreement, you require stock brokerage agreements for both exchanges and whatever segments that are there, and a PMS agreement and a whatever power of attorney, all these things come into the picture. So it becomes quite a cumbersome thing trying to onboard clients, and that is a hassle. And somewhere we felt that the cost advantages of a fund structure, both in terms of the fees that we can charge, the overall market efficiencies or the tax advantages to some extent in the fund structure, all these are much better from the client perspective. That has worked in our favor. So today we charge a far lesser fee to the client per 1 lakh or per 1 crore as compared to what we were charging. Absolute amount is much larger for us given the size of the assets, but it's a cost-effective investment operation from the client perspective, and that has worked out well. Another thing that has worked well is that in the PMS structure, the performance was between us and the clients. So although the first decade, 2003 to 2013, we were doing well for our clients, but hardly anyone knew about us. 2013 to date, whatever we have done, good, bad, ugly, whatever has been the investment outcome, that is widely known. So to that extent, it helps in getting customers and getting noticed. Also, what has changed for us and for the fund industry in general is that everyone talks about this Jam Trinity, Jan Dhan, Aadhaar Mobile, and Easy KYC and all. So the first step was people getting bank accounts, but I think we are also going to the next step of people opening DMAT accounts, especially in the post-COVID period where so many of these discount brokers came on the scene and they have really started getting customers. So unique investors in mutual funds across the industry have gone up from somewhere 2.5 crores to roughly 4.5 crores now within last 3-4 years. So that has been a big shift. It's to an extent also an Amazon kind of movement for investment managers and fund houses. So earlier you had to be a Unilever to sell consumer products in India, or someone who had distribution. So you had to be a bank sponsored fund or someone with a large corporate branch network. With digitization and with this Aadhaar-based KYC and common KYC across fund houses and things like that, what has happened is people need to just focus on the investment management aspect. And the to an extent, the getting customers has become easier across India.
So seems like you have timed your this thing also pretty well, right? Because the numbers have doubled, mutual fund investors have, and the shift of corpuses also have happened from different asset classes to equities in general, mutual funds in more particular. You said good, bad, ugly. I really doubt any of your three bosses, which you tend to say. I don't think anybody would call it ugly in any stretch of the world. But boy, these three bosses must be very happy so far with your performance. But given that, you know, and I think you have touched it earlier also in some interviews, but the size is now significant, right? You were managing somewhere around few thousand crores to now close to 60,000 crore, if I'm not wrong, from the last disclosure. With that, has it curbed you in any sense? So sure, your past journey has been good, but what do you tell your investors now, especially when they share concern on the size on the equity side?
Sure. So touching on three bosses first before I come to the size. The bosses are very fickle, at least two of them. Like Jeff Bezos would say that customers every day want more selection, lower prices, faster delivery time. Doesn't matter what you have delivered. So same day delivery, people will want 10-minute delivery. So bosses are very tough, and you can't rest on your past performance and get a leeway.
For the benefit of people, since I didn't mention this, three bosses are your own boss, which is your CEO, your MFDs, and your clients, right? So just for the benefit of the listeners, yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah. So the bosses ask us, what have you done for me lately? Not what have you done for us over the past 10 years? Yeah. So coming to size, is it different? Surely, yes. So when we started the mutual fund, we were at 300 crores, now at 60 plus thousand crores. Obviously, you can't invest in a 100 crore market cap and move the needle. So surely that has changed. What does not change is that even when we were smaller, we were not a high churn focused investment house. So approach even then was buy and hold. So what people have to realize is that size matters to the extent I am a buyer or a seller in stocks on a daily basis. As long as the share is lying dormant in the DMAT account, It doesn't matter whether you have 1 share or 1 crore shares in the company. That quantity just has to remain there. And the extent of buying and selling that we do does not matter for any large cap company that we own. It does not matter for 60-70% of the mid caps that we own. It may matter in some smaller mid caps or in some small caps that we have. So in the last unit holders meet, I made this point that look at us as a Russian doll or as the Matryoshka dolls that are there. I hope I got the word right. For the top names that you see in the portfolio, those are very similar to the names that we had 10 years back. Nothing much has changed. So HDFC Bank was a large position then, is a large position today. So or Google was there earlier, Google is there today. And Google doesn't care that I am 60,000 crore plus, meaning that their market cap can can absorb 6 lakh crore even. So those haven't changed. At the lower end of the market cap spectrum, the change that increasingly will happen is that look at it as a small or a mid-cap fund within the flexi-cap fund. So there'll be more number of names, lesser weightage to each company, and so on. Again, just for context, a mid-cap fund is equal to the size of our flexi-cap fund, the largest mid-cap in the industry. It just seems that the size questions are, I'm a magnet for attracting these size questions, and other people who run tens of thousands of crores of small cap funds and mid cap funds seem to get away with running those.
So, I think the size question comes more in your context probably, and it's a guess, I could be wrong here, is also because you tend to have a bit more concentration than the other mutual funds we have seen, right? Other mutual funds will generally have, to the size of these, the size you're talking about, parallel size mutual funds, they would have much more number of stocks. Their top position will not be as, if I'm not wrong, your current top position will be around 8 to 9% of your holding. That will not be the case with them. And they will be a bit more spread out. So your top 10 stocks will be 50% of your corpus, whereas the top 10 will be around 30% of the corpus in the other mutual funds. So maybe from that vantage point, people tend to ask this question often because maybe size constraint matter more when you're a bit more concentrated on the top. Is that a fair assessment, or do you think that's different?
Absolutely. So can I continue to have large positions in HDFC Bank, Bajaj Holdings, Amazon, Google? Yes. Can I have something like a CDSL as 8% of my overall corpus? Answer is no, because then you would end up breaching the limits that regulators have on a as percentage of the paid up capital of the company. So you will not find very, very small companies being a very large portion of our holdings on a fund basis. At the same time, while our approach is a bit more concentrated, we don't spread ourselves too thin overall. As I mentioned, we are largely buy and hold. So the position buildup can happen over months, over years. It's not that one fine day I have to wake up and suddenly impact the market with upper circuits or lower circuits if I'm buying or selling. We are patient in terms of our purchases and sales, and we will buy only at the right time and price if the opportunity is there. So, yeah, and for the smaller companies, you will see lower weightages in our portfolio on a per stock basis, and you'll see a larger number of names in the portfolio. Yes.
Am I right in assuming that the top positions or the larger companies' performance in general will tend to have more impact on your portfolio returns over a period of time, given that you're spread a bit more thin on the smaller companies, and smaller companies tend to not really move together that much unless the small cap boom is happening like what we saw last year when every company was doing what it, I mean, you just have to throw dart on the board, seems to be at least. Have you tried to dissect your returns over a period of time? Has it evolved in any way, or does it remain same? I hope the question is clear.
Yeah. So, one is that we can have different opinions on this, but my feeling is that small caps and mid caps do tend to move together in some manner. So, in a bull market, the mid cap indices will rise faster than large caps. Small cap will rise even faster than mid caps. And in a falling market, the reverse happens. So, mid caps will be falling faster than large caps, and small caps would be falling even faster. We tend to be somewhat contracyclical. So, in March 2020 kind of situation, we were buying smaller companies as well, wherever there was supply and wherever blocks were available or volumes were happening on screen. So, a lot of our in that period, most of the attention went to something like ITC that we bought in March 2020. But at the same time, we were buyers in a lot of small and mid-cap companies in those months of March and April 2020. So around that time, we would have picked up things like CDSL, IEX, MCX, various smaller companies, Oracle Financial Services, software services, and things like that. So when things are down and out, and or if someone is facing redemption pressures, then they don't care about what is the valuation of the company or what are the future prospects. If the redemption requirement is there, people have to sell. And in a down market, you get these wonderful blocks in small and mid-cap companies. So while individual names, you may have smaller weightages just to them, but you find equivalent companies in that space as well. So instead of one smaller or mid-cap IT services companies, you could get two to make up for the larger fund size. I don't see that as a challenge. In the current environment, we are deliberately not going aggressive in that space. So there is this mutual fund platform called Overa, which puts out weekly data on the funds which got maximum flows and funds which got maximum redemptions, top five funds on a weekly basis on their platform. It's not across the industry, but is there for their platform. And if you look at that data, three to four funds out of the top five are in the small and mid-cap space in recent times,
On the redemption side, you mean?
on the investment side. So most of
Okay,
the money has
even
been
now.
coming, yeah, even now. So,
Okay.
some of the better performing funds right now. So,
Sure.
it's at an appropriate time, I am sure we'll be able to deploy money in small and mid caps. It's not that we don't have coverage there. It is just that we don't want to be chasing prices or buy at any price or ignore valuation.
Actually, this question was kept for much later, but since you have touched upon this, let me ask this. And I would request listeners to also go back and listen to the past recording, because I don't want to ask the same questions over and over again. I want to build over what you discussed the last time. We touched in detail about your investment philosophy and selection criterias, and as every value investor in our country tends to or tries to do, we tend to look at companies where the valuations are reasonable given the fundamentals. So we're not talking absolute cheap P's or cheap price to book stocks, but we are also, I mean, so the valuation is justified by the fundamentals, and we are looking at unleveraged clean books, etc., etc., and a growth. So you're looking at growth at reasonable valuations kind of stocks, and you're not typically on the asset bargains, so to speak, not on the Graham side of things, more like Charlie Munger, Buffett philosophy. In markets like these, when you tend to have an across the board non-justification to some extent, I mean, sure, you can justify a few companies and probably they are part of your portfolios, but for many companies, it becomes difficult to justify the valuations they are in, given the fundamentals, reinvestment possibilities, growth, etc. And I remember your talk on DCF being the Hubble telescope and not tend to look that far because the variations are too high. How do you position your portfolio? Because my guess is that you're not really allowed to be in too much cash. Or let's say many people have tendency to be in full-time cash, whether by mandate or by preference. How do people behave in this kind of market? How they should behave? What's your guidance to those people who do DIY investing, but did not find in a market where there's too much and they still want to be in equities? What do you suggest they should do in these kind of markets?
Talking about ourselves, we don't force ourselves to be fully invested at all times. In fact, most times we have a little bit of cash to meet the inflows and redemptions and not having to go to buy every day or sell every day depending on inflow or redemptions. At peak, we have been as much as 30% in cash plus arbitrage positions. So we can be in cash, and as we speak, the last fact sheet we have shown, it would have around 14-14.5% cash holdings plus arbitrage in our schemes. So my lived experience in markets, both as a individual and as a professional investor, starts from 92 in terms of the bull markets that I have seen. So barring the 92 bull market where everything was way overboard and everything was frothy, what I've seen is in each bull market where there are excesses, there are pockets where people are not looking, or there are opportunities. So late 90s, when the bull market was all about the new economy, anything that was classified as old economy was available at reasonable valuations. 2007, ironically, the bull market was in real estate, infra, commodities, and what was new economy in late 90s was ignored at that point in time. So you could actually have bought things like Infosys or Wipro in 2007 and made money on a 3-year basis despite the global financial crisis. You could have bought FMCG, pharma, any of those things. 2017, the froth was in small and mid caps, and you could still find some opportunities in the larger companies. So I think there are opportunities in most markets, and this thing that everything is nosebleed valuations, I don't completely agree with that. In today's market, for example, and I've said this numerous times, so nothing new that I'm saying, I think private sector banks are looking attractive. Now, if you look at names like HDFC, Kotak, Axis, ICICI, all these are very close to the pre-COVID levels. They haven't really participated so much in the overall rally. Now, some people have differing views. So I just was watching Sanjay Bhattacharya and his talk at in Delhi at the CFA event. He says all these have gone through management changes and I'm not sure how they will be run. Banks are very tough to analyze and things could go wrong and things like that. So people could have a differing view, but I think one has to look at pockets where the froth is not there and where things are reasonable.
Okay, so you're basically advising that generally in any market, the froth is going to be there, in even if at peak of the markets, it's not going to be in all the pockets. In that sense, I'm also guessing that you have a restriction on sectoral allocations, if I'm not wrong. I don't know whether MF schemes have sectoral allocations limitations. And that is, even if you want to be on peak cash, I mean, currently you're on 14% cash or something. Is that the right number? 14?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm guessing that there will be periods when the other pockets are not big enough to fill the remaining, you know, 80-90% of the cash. In that scenario, and you also have a international equity portion to your investment, does that shift from here to there, or is there anything else you do, or maybe you tend to just shift to the names which you think if fall will fall less? So it's like making yourself a bit more resilience rather than trying to chase the upward market.
Yeah. So given that we are allowed use of derivatives, we can be in arbitrage positions where you are long a stock and you sell the futures on the same stock, and which is equivalent to a cash holding. So there is no restriction on cash holdings per se or cash equivalents per se. We could be as low as 15%, 1.5 in direct stocks. So we don't force ourselves to be invested at all times. That is one. Second, while from regulatory perspective, from trustee and board guidelines, and from even from prudence perspective, one would not want to be 50-60% in the sector, obviously. The limits that are there under the mutual fund regulations are pretty liberal. So one can have reasonable overweight positions in the companies and sectors that one likes. So I don't see that as too much of a challenge.
Sure. So Rajiv, this question is an outcome of a lot of discussion people have nowadays about the evolution of the market. We have seen that the markets are dramatically different from what they were 5 years back. And when I say market, I'm talking about market participants, the ecosystem of the equity markets, a lot of younger investors making way into the equity markets. And except for COVID, which surprised everybody, I think it must have surprised you as much as anybody in the world, the pace at which it happened, the unpreparedness, and then the, if that wasn't enough, the recovery from there was just surprising on all ends. Barring that very small blip, a lot of people have not seen too much of volatility on the downward side, and the access to information have also increased dramatically. So majority of the people know about the SME space, small cap companies, a lot of research is available, et cetera, et cetera. In this kind of a market, generally they say that, the gaps tend to close much faster. So let's say you're buying ITC, for example, just for example's sake. There were times when you buy a position long back and you had to wait for a long period of time for the value to be realized. And people were aware of that as fund managers. Nowadays, and it was a communication with one of the fund managers who said that nowadays I'm not sure that if I'm waiting for too long, am I wrong, or is just that the market is taking that much time? Because generally market does not take that much time to realize that gap. Is that your experience also in some way? Let's say a position doesn't work for long. Do you tend to question yourself a bit more than in past?
I don't think human behavior has changed.
I think I lost
earlier,
you, Rajiv.
There is a story of Rothschilds getting information about the war outcome on a carrier pigeon.
Rajiv, I'm really sorry, but I think I lost you in the middle for a minute. Can you just re-answer that if possible?
Sure. I don't think human behavior has changed, while information accessibility has changed very, very dramatically. So there is this story about Rothschilds getting the outcome of a war on a carrier pigeon, and they had information before anybody else and they could make money in the markets. Today you have internet and you have machines analyzing information and directly trading without needing a human to read what the outcome is. So reaction times have become quicker, but stupidity hasn't gone away. And despite all this, we still take 9 months for a baby to be born. So we still haven't gone to so gestation period hasn't gone away. So the time taken to build a business or the time taken for strategy shifts to work out for a company, the patience required to hold a position, all these haven't gone away. Again, this is an example where things went right, but things could have gone wrong. But just to make a point, we owned a company called Persistent Systems for around 5 years. And for 4 years, the stock did nothing. It was flatlining. So every year we would have to answer questions as to why is this happening. And many a times we keep getting mocked for the stock picks that are there. So ITC got mocked and we got mocked with ITC. Today, HDFC Bank people make fun of and make fun of us as well. So it's not that the variant perception has gone away. The same data, different people will look at it differently. Some people will look at a company and its numbers and say, oh, it doesn't matter. Right now, earnings are not there. So what? There is huge market potential and it will earn a lot of money down the road and let's go and buy it today. And at the other end, people say, so what if this is a 5P stock and a 10% dividend yield stock? There are ESG concerns and this will happen and that will happen and we should not buy it. So I don't think all those things have gone away. The bouts of ups and downs still continue. It's not that stocks are going up in a linear fashion. Bouts of greed and fear, anchoring bias, representativeness, all those things are still relevant today.
Let me just add a bit more example to this and also try to, I mean, real life examples are the best way to learn behavior. Okay, so we can talk theory as much as we want, but real life examples tend to strengthen that behavior. Let's say an ITC kind of a stock. And again, ITC, I'm not talking about your holding per se, but generally how the stock behaved, right? An ITC was or could have been argued to be a good value buy long back. And the returns we have seen now, a year and a half returns, if you look at an XIRR basis for a longer holding period, they tend to basically the 120% will go to, let's say, a 20% CAGR or 25% CAGR over a long term. A common argument I hear against that is that if you find a value stock, don't buy it immediately and buy it on its way up rather than on its way down. Now, of course, there could be a size building, position building angle to that. But is there any other logical fallacy you think in that argument? Because that's a very common argument I have seen people coming up with. And the same is true for HDFC today. They say, buy it when it is moving up. What's the big deal? You can deploy a crazy amount of cash when it starts to move up. What do you say on that front?
So I've seen literature on this. Academics have done work on this. And they say that buying stocks at 52-week lows is not that great an idea because things may not work out in the near term. Academics have analyzed and they say typically mean reversion happens between 3 and 5 years. So something which has languished for a long period of time is a better purchase anywhere from 36 months to maybe 60 months. Underperformance is better than a 52-week kind of or a 12-month kind of period. So I have no argument against that. If a stock has languished for longer and it's available very, very cheap, that is better. But I will not hold, I will not stay away from buying something if it's very, very attractive just because 12-month price return is not that great or 6-month price return is not that great or if it's not looking good on the charts. I recognize that trying to just buy around the intrinsic value or 5% discount than intrinsic or 10% discount than the intrinsic value may not be that great because it could still fall lower. Let people vent out their frustration on the stock, let people dump it and I would buy it. But I don't wait for the up move. One thing that you mentioned is volumes. So bulk of the volumes happen on the way down. This has been at least my experience in terms of trying to execute transactions. The amount that I've been able to purchase, and not just now, even at smaller fund sizes, the amount and ease with which I've been able to purchase when the stock is flat or slightly downwards is far more than once it starts moving up. Because once people start chasing it and you say, okay, I don't mind paying up 2%, 3% higher, you don't get fills. If you put a bid 3% higher than the current market price, there'll be someone else who will come and put a bid 5% higher. Then everyone is just upbidding it without actual volumes happening. So
I buy this and generally, you know, whenever I had this discussion, first of all, if you go by the data historically, you don't get 2% or 3% higher. You basically build your position at a 20-30% higher prices. So that is the money you let go. So it's always a question of if you are stuck in a position, how long the position takes for it to give you returns. If that period is too long, sure, that argument holds, but it's not very practical because we don't know when the stocks is going to really move around much. So if, let's say, you buy HDFC and HDFC start doing very well from, you know, from the moment of buying, or maybe a few months down the line, your XIRs are going to be much, much higher than if you're trying to time it here and there. Another problem I have seen is it's difficult to do that timing. It's theoretically an easy thing to say to enter on a breakout or whatever people try to time on, but they don't behave the way you know, the science, they're supposed to make it a science, but it's not.
There are people who have been successful traders. There are people like, let's say, Rentec or Jim Simons and all, who have used price volume data to earn very, very good, decent returns. Somewhere down the line, that is black box thinking. Because statistically this has worked, I will follow that and I'll hopefully make some money. That is what people are trying to do. Buying things which have given the maximum positive return over a 6 to 12 month period will give me returns. So that's why I'll do it. Now, there could come a time when all those companies in that list are either bankrupt or fraudulent companies. And we have seen this kind of a situation in the tech boom, where barring maybe a Infy or a Wipro, which are genuine companies, there were a lot of shady companies in the list where things were going up. And end of the day, you would end up owning those, and people think, oh, if it goes down, I'll put a stop loss and get out of it. We have seen lower circuits continuously for a long period of time. If you invest from first principle basis, where you say owning equity is owning a part of that business, who are the people running the business? Am I comfortable partnering with them? What is, end of the day, their business? Is it something that I like? What is the balance sheet and P&L and cash flow statement telling you? If the markets were to shut down, and Buffett keeps saying this, it's a mental framework. It's not that markets are going to shut down for 5 years, but if you did not have a price on that stock for 5 years, would you be comfortable owning this as a private business? If the answer is yes, that gives you comfort, because the business trajectory will go in a particular direction, the dividends will come, the profit growth will be seen. If you don't have any anchor, and the only anchor that you have is price volume, then it could be very, very choppy, and someday it could lead to absolute junk landing up in your portfolio. That's a risk.
Fair point. But I was actually referring to those investors who are fundamentally oriented investors. And they do their filtrations, and the stocks are of good quality, the businesses are good, but then they are trying to build the timing element to the entry and exit of the position. So in that space, I was referring to most of the conversations which I have with people nowadays, and with size and without size. I'm talking both type of people. But anyways,
so whatever works for people. So yeah. If it works for you,
I doubt
great.
It works. That is what I'm trying to gauge, whether it works or not.
And my personal experiences while buying as well as while selling, again, while sell, the whatever you are asking for buying could also be theoretically asked for selling. If it's going up and if trend is up, why do you sell if it's overvalued? Hold on, let the price crack a bit, and then you could sell it on the way down. My personal experience has been that trimming positions when you start getting uncomfortable from a valuation perspective helps. You may not get the absolute top price, and neither do I make a bullet exit. So if I think intrinsic value is 100, then up to 130, 140, it could just be a range. You need not do anything. Beyond, let's say, 140, 150, you start reducing the weightage. And the full exit may happen maybe 175 to 100 kind of thing. But if you say that I will wait for the stock to go to 200, and then when it falls to 190 or 185, then I'll start selling. That becomes very, very challenging. Then exits become very, very difficult. Same way on the buying side, if the price is 100, I'm not buying it at 95. that could be my error of calculating intrinsic value. But if it is 50 and I say charts are not looking good, or if the price trend is not there, then I'll buy it when it goes to 60 and I see a clear trend, then it hasn't worked for me. I would start buying it at 60, 55 gradually and build a position over time.
Yeah, actually, you answered the next question I was about to ask, which is when valuation actually tends to cross, how do you behave? And again, it's a perfect example you have given. The argument which we hear often from trying timing perspective is that, okay, Rajiv, you believe it's 100 and it is 140, but markets are irrational and this 140 can be 400 also. You have no way of knowing the extremes. I mean, generally, this kind of an argument we often hear. So when you sell at 180, you are presuming that there is a upper limit to it, but in the irrational markets, that's not tend to be the case. And hence, even if we lose from the top, we are okay and we probably get, but again, theoretically, all good. Practically, I'm not sure how. And that is why I'm trying to, because I have seen you reading or building your knowledge based on a lot of things which are not directly in the space. You have read or understood or implemented, I'm not sure, but quantitative side of things, factor based, and we'll come to that later on. And you have been a bond investment banking, so you've seen the cycles. So maybe that's why I'm trying to gauge your impression on that. So what you're saying is, what you practice is that you start trimming down the position the moment it becomes slightly uncomfortable, or maybe a bit more uncomfortable, let's say 30-40%. I know there is no practical way of marking the numbers there, it's a range, but the moment you get a feeling that okay, it's going beyond, you start trimming your position, and you'll probably exit at a slightly crazier valuation, and then the money would shift to cash or an next opportunity if available. Is that fair?
Yes.
Fair point. Hi friends, I hope you're enjoying this particular episode. I just want to take a minute and thank the sponsors for this episode. Stoic Talks was built on a premise of actionable insights and detailed questioning, and that usually requires the independence of doing that work. When you're looking for somebody to partner with, you are not only looking for somebody who will share your ethos, but also will promote this independence of asking fearless questions without any hesitations. So when we were looking for someone like that, the obvious first choice for me was a DSP mutual fund. I have known their team. I have worked with them for a long period of time. You know, they have this tagline called #InvestForGood, which I really like because it really associates, which in my observation, I have seen them living this as the way of their life, and which is very visible. If you follow their work in public, they have done some excellent research efforts. They've come up with some amazing reports, which everybody enjoys reading. For example, they have this report called Netra. Then there is the transcript, which talks about the concall transcripts. Then there is the annual report, Nectar, the Navigator, and many such reports, which I enjoy reading and is enjoyed by many practitioners in the investment community. So we are extremely proud to be working with such a team. They completely agree with our vision for Stoic Talks, and I really want to thank them for supporting this particular episode. And if you aren't already, I would highly recommend you to follow them on Twitter. With their Twitter ID is @DSPMF. So thanks once again and enjoy listening to this show.
Yes.
Fair point. You know, and with that, just a parallel question from learning from your experiences. Have you ever had a position when you actually sold out because of the pressure that the company is just not, you know, the price value gap is just not closing, no matter how much, you know, time has passed and the company is giving results? Has it ever happened in your experience that you had to sell position?
So when I sold, the same arguments that I had when I bought remained valid, but the holding period was more than 6-7 years. And
any example you would care to share if possible?
It's not a stock that we currently own, so
sure.
Probably can talk about it. So Mahindra Holidays.
Okay.
It's an asset light business model where you take money from customers upfront that largely funds your fresh hotel projects. Again, typical problem with hotels is occupancy. If occupancy is low, then operating leverage works against you. Here, sure, you have pre-sold your room nights. The occupancy at which they run is very, very high. And plus you get annual fee and you get F&B revenues and other activity revenues and things like that. So business model was something that I like. That same situation continued, but the scaling hasn't happened as much. So in fact, after we sold, to an extent, there has been this post-COVID travel bounce, both in actual consumption as well as the perception of investors. Yeah, but it somehow did not scale as much as one would have thought.
For the learning of, you know, younger investors who haven't gone through a lot of cycles, I think one key learning to take here is your mental framework to actually sell after you have held it for so long becomes even more difficult, because you've held it for so long, you think maybe now is the time it will actually start moving, and becomes difficult and difficult for you to sell. So at some point you have to draw a line and say, okay, maybe I'm wrong, or maybe there's something which I'm missing. Like, I remember Monish writing in his letters that, you know, if I'm not recalling it correct, I don't want to misquote him, but maybe he has like a 2-year or 3-year time frame after which he accepts a mistake and move on kind of a period. Is that a fair framework to have for investors when doing the value approach, when you're looking for that valuation gap to close and not playing the cycle?
Sure. So we have somewhat longer horizons. So we are looking at five year plus kind of horizons. But again, about things going wrong, first thing to realize is that investing is more akin to playing a bridge game rather than playing chess. And there's a big difference. In chess, you know where each piece is and how the pieces will move and what are the rules. All those are static. Rules don't change, and there's perfect information. You see your pieces and you see the opponent's pieces on the board very, very clearly. There's no information asymmetry. In bridge, you will only know your cards. You may not know your opponent's cards, and you will not know how they will react and things like that. So in investing, will something catch popularity, or will something not catch popularity? All of these are uncertain, and no amount of market research or no amount of scuttlebutt or harassing the management for guidance will give you perfect information. So before starting, one has to realize that maybe out of 10 decisions that you make, 3 could turn out to be wrong. So there's no shame in some investments not working out for you. And if everything is working out in your favor, maybe you are not, then you are too conservative. Maybe you are not making enough attempts in terms of avoiding errors of omission. So you are probably leaving too much money on the table by not taking enough risk. So I would expect some investments in our portfolio not working out down the road. And I don't know which ones. If I knew, I wouldn't buy them. But by sheer probability, some will not work out. And the good part is that in investments, as long as you are not too overextended in one or two positions, the ones that don't work out, as it has become a smaller and smaller portion of your portfolio as time goes by. And then it's easy to just sell those and move on. So if you had 20 stocks, 5% weight, 19 of your stocks doubled, and that one 5% remained at 5 or went to 4 or 3, then it's easy to just sell that and move on. So what mistake one should not make is doubling down on things that are not working. That is a mistake to guard against.
It's interesting you say that's a mistake, because mistakes are in hindsight, right? We don't know when we are in the position whether it's a mistake or not. But let's dissect it from the behavior which we have seen in your fund, for example. If I'm not wrong, HDFC a year back would have been a much smaller position, and I'm guessing a lot of money would have gone into that position, right? So you would have built from a 3% position or a 4%, I don't remember the numbers, to let's say a 8% position today. Where do you draw that line? Because you said don't double down on a mistake, but you don't know it's a mistake. That's why you double down often.
Sure. So I'll give context to the bank position. So bank positions we had reduced post-COVID, where banking sector was the only leveraged business that we had. All others are debt-free or close to debt-free companies. And after COVID, we did not know what would be the default rate. So the borrowers may be great borrowers. So for example, I am a conservative borrower. For example, if I have taken a home loan, I have full intent of repaying the bank. I don't have any fraudulent intention. But if because of COVID, if I lose my job and I don't have a salary, then I may unwillingly be forced into a default or a NPA kind of situation. So around COVID time, banking sector was the only sector where we reduced the weightages a bit, which we went back more or less to pre-COVID levels shortly thereafter. So HDFC Bank was a big position in any case. Now, when I'm saying mistake, I'm not saying essentially about stock price performance. What I'm talking about is the business performance. Let's talk about Mahindra Holidays, because don't have a position there right now and can probably look at it neutrally. It is not that we sold because stock price was not moving up. We sold because the business was not performing as per expectations after giving it sufficient time. So when we say that in India there is this growing middle class and there are some people who are upper middle class, and when per capita income crosses a certain level, people start spending on discretionary items of consumption. All that is the typical stories that we hear as to how discretionary consumption will pick up. Now, that should be seen in the member additions, in the revenue numbers and things like that. Now, that evidence was not being seen. So, despite time going by, that uptick that I would have thought was not being reflected. So, stock may do nothing for a long period of time. I've mentioned something like a persistent. Now, there we saw traction in terms of their being able to maintain and grow sales, although a bit slower than the industry, but they were able to also recruit from outside good talent from some of the bigger IT companies. So, if the business is going in a direction that you expect, then I don't think we worry too much about stock price, and then some reduction in stock price would be a buying opportunity. When I'm saying a mistake is, let's say we owned a bridge company in Noida toll bridge. Now, here the court said you can't charge a toll, which is the high court decision. Now, they could go into an appeal or legal matters take time, or they could go into for arbitration with the UP government. But the basic premise that you are to earn a revenue on each car that goes by, if that has been cancelled, then obviously it's a business mistake. It's a investing mistake. Then you can't say stock price is lower than where I was earlier buying and now I'll double down.
Fair point. I fully agree. And just to synthesize what you just said for the benefit of the listeners also, so what you're basically saying is that business performance eventually, so when you're betting on a stock, you're also talking about, you're basically taking a call on the business performance and not on the price performance. That is an outcome of the business performance in the long run. And business performance key parameters, if they are disappointing, you're calling that as a mistake because your thesis is not playing through, and don't double down on those positions. But if that is working well, the position is actually much better than when you entered into because the business is doing what it does, which can be argued to some extent in your current large holdings also, but let's not talk about them. When you are building on or doubling down to these positions, do you also have a risk management in place in terms of percentages, or you go by the regulatory caps? How do you think about that?
Yeah, so you don't want to breach regulatory cap, obviously, so which is 10% in a particular company. So typical weightage at the upper end would be roughly around 8% or slightly higher than that. You don't want to be too exposed to a particular sector. So there are sectoral weightages as well. You don't want too much of correlation in your portfolio. So despite some sectors being outside, you don't want everything to be linked to, let's say, the financial sector, for example. So you want to keep those under check. Again, you have to allow for mistakes in your process where some information does not turn out to be the way you have anticipated. So, for example, some bank could be suppressing NPA disclosures or things like that. So you don't want to be overexposed to those kind of things. So buying additional stock to maintain weightage, if reported numbers are going your way and if things are otherwise looking fine, is okay. But you don't want to overextend yourself and make a position such that it becomes a fatal thing, that if this one stock does not work out, then your entire effort of your investing career or your entire portfolio sinks with it. So you don't want it to be that kind of a position.
Got it. Rajiv, you invest internationally also. And last time when we had a discussion, you explained the future prices differential, which is beneficial for Indian investors when they're doing hedging. In fact, if I'm quoting you correctly, you said it's a cost when a foreigner invests in India, but it's an income when an Indian investor is basically hedging his position outside. Is that still the case? And if I would probably want you to repeat anything from the previous discussion, it would be this part, because I still feel not a lot of people understand this. And if somebody is lazy enough not to go back and listen to that podcast, he still should get this point. So can you explain that part and how you're thinking about your international investments now?
I'll explain it, but it's largely a theoretical discussion at this point in time, and I'll tell you why. So let us say interest rates in the US, for argument's sake, let us say 1 year treasury bill is 4% in US and 1 year treasury bill is 7% in India. These are not actual numbers, just for simplicity's sake. Now, if you invest $1 abroad, that $1 will become $1.04 after a year. If you invest 83 rupees in India, that will be 83 into 1.07, whatever that number is. Now, after a year, if you compare 1.04 with 83 into 1.07, that will be the 1 year forward price, which roughly is 3% higher than the current spot rupee price, which is the difference between 7% and 4%, the interest rate differential between the two countries. So when a foreigner invests in India, that person will have to pay a 3% cost to take back the money. Because otherwise, if that cost were not to be there, if today spot dollar is 83 and 1 year forward spot dollar is also 83, people could simply borrow money in the US at 4%, invest in India at 7% and pocket the 3% difference. In order to for that not to happen, the future or forward dollar rupee will trade at a 3% discount. This today, the reason I say it's largely theoretical is that regulators, whoever they be, exchanges, RBI, SEBI, there has been a change in the way people can participate. So now there is, effective May sometime, there is a thing that unless you have an underlying position, you cannot transact in the futures market. Now, even for people who have underlying position, just to create the documentation and for the broker to check that and all that. So recently, one of the Zerodha founders had said that we are stopping this currency futures activity on our platform and things like that. So market may not be that active going forward. So let's see how it pans out. But again, the interest rates in India and US have narrowed somewhat. So that what used to be a 3% differential would be now down to some 2-2.5%, I would think. So
I would like to probably ask a bit more on your view. And again, nothing to think against the regulations. There's always a rationale behind whatever step is taken. So in all their wisdom, if a step is taken like that, but there's a counterpoint to any regulatory step which happens like this, which is that it creeps in inefficiencies rather than the role of the regulator should be promoting efficiencies in the market. These kind of steps tend to increase inefficiencies. Would you agree with that viewpoint? Or there is a larger picture that justifies this kind of, you know, inefficiencies might be beneficial? What's your viewpoint here?
Yeah, it takes a lot of time and effort to build something. And when we take steps, we have to realize that if something comes to a grinding halt, then again to bring it back to the current state will again take that much time and effort. So to build a currency futures market took a lot of time and effort by various participants to make it functioning. Now, I'm sure, as you said, they would have their own compulsions, but if for some reason people just stop participating, then one big segment simply goes away, which people have felt that segment is desirable. So for various reasons, for corporates to hedge and for some people to indulge in a little bit of speculative activity. Anyway, there were caps on unhedged positions and things like that. So yeah, and too frequent a change really doesn't allow anyone to plan. So let us say there is a road, Mumbai Pune in my case, or Delhi Agra for you, or something like that. On that highway, after due deliberations, if people put in certain speed limits for safety of passengers, for safety of travelers, as well as not to unduly slow down the whole vehicular movement. Let us say you say 70 kilometers per hour is the speed limit, now which people are abide by and things go smoothly. Now, if you keep tinkering with that all the time, today the speed limit will be 50, tomorrow it goes up to 90, then again 45, then again 70, then people really don't know what they are supposed to do, which creates all this uncertainty. So too much of a frequent change actually unsettles the whole system.
Actually, this reminds me of something. In the last discussion, and it was long back, so probably you, I don't know if you recall it, but we had a discussion around the Indian ecosystem pertaining to activism in general. And the reason we did this was because of a choice of why a Graham asset-centric investing is difficult to practice in India, and there was an activism ecosystem. And while there were some green shots in terms of regulatory improvements and, you know, the advisory bodies coming into picture, there wasn't much improvement, or the speed of improvement was not as much. We recently have the case of ICICI Securities in news because of the similar kind of things. Now, I would suppose that given the AUM you manage, there is a larger role you can play as a, you know, in the activism space. How do you see, first, as a responsibility, as a large AUM manager, as a responsibility? And secondly, do you think the ecosystem is at least at par improved or not improved? What is your viewpoint on that?
Much improved. So what has happened is that mutual funds have a mandate to vote on everything that comes our way. So we cannot say we'll abstain from voting. We have to either vote in favor or we have to vote against, and we have to document the reasons why we voted for or we voted against something. And our own analysts will do their work and analyze, but at the same time, we get reports from these advisory bodies with their viewpoint. And if everyone has the same opinion, that is fine. But if we overrule the advisory recommendation, then we should have valid reasons why we are overruling it. So It is not that automatically we vote in favor of each resolution that the management proposes. In the past, in many cases, the proposed resolution had to be dropped because the sentiment of institutional investors, retail investors, was so much against a particular thing. So that has changed. What has not changed is the shareholding pattern, largely. Now, you can vote against a particular director or a particular resolution, and that could fail to pass through if it's a related party transaction. But if Government of India owns 75% in the company, if a MNC owns 60% in the company, or if a business family owns 55%, 60% in the company, you cannot change the management. The CEO will remain the CEO. You cannot force them to demerge something. You cannot force them to do anything. You can just block a related party transaction as a minority shareholder. So to that extent, we don't have activism where people launch a hostile takeover or something like that. What we have is stewardship activity where we vote on whether someone is eligible to be an independent director or not. We vote on managerial compensation. We vote on related party transactions and things like that.
Just to extend this further, Rajiv. So fine, there is a regulation for you to act on a position that you have. And if you're taking a decision against the advisory, you have to give reasons and all. And that's all fine and fair. But the business ecosystem largely hardly ever does anything fine and fair as per from a shareholder's perspective. If they're not getting what they're not getting, there is always a hue and cry. I mean, just to give an example, recently for ICICI Securities, there was a lot of noise around, and I don't know whether it is true or not, factual or not, but there has been case when ICICI Bank is doing things on behalf of ICICI Securities. And the main issue that has always been against activism is that there is no repercussions for larger entities when things go off base, which is basically the policing aspect of it or whatever you want to call it. That seems to have not improved from whatever my conversation is with larger shareholders in companies. And they say that even if, let's say, we have a strong viewpoint, it's that the organizations don't tend to get punished is not maybe the right word, I'm not sure. So that side of things has not changed. But yeah, from a regulation perspective, to force the larger shareholders to act has come up. Is that a fair assessment or there is something which people are not understanding? Or it's a good direction we are taking, let's call it that and move from there.
Going in a good direction, and like, for example, there was this whole in the past where Suzuki was setting up a plant in India and which would sell to the listed company Maruti. And that time, there were minority shareholders who were protesting, and Suzuki and Maruti together engaged with the shareholders and listened to their concerns and tried to work out a solution which was acceptable to all parties. And after that, the resolution went through, and now, in fact, that plant incrementally will be part of Maruti India's operations. So it is not that nothing happened. So I'm not cynical. Okay, things just remain they are, and there is no improvement whatsoever. A lot of improvements have happened. I don't know much about ICICI and ICICI Securities. I think people were upset that they were canvassing votes for them, for their point of view, but which is a legit thing. Now, people opposing can also canvass, and people in favor of a resolution can also canvass. It's like in any voting, we are currently going through general elections and some state elections and all, people canvass and try to convince people of their point of view. So I don't see that as so much of a issue, but I don't know much about it. We did not own shares in the ICICI Securities, and I don't know much about it.
No, fair point. I mean, I'm just trying to take your view on evolution of activism culture, so to speak, when shareholders can get together and impact, make a real impact, so to speak. And And I think even the ICICI shares, ICICI, and I'm just quoting it because it is so recent in the memory of the audience. But there, though, I think the major concern was why ICICI Bank is acting on behalf of ICICI Securities, or the sharing of list on all that kind of shareholder information. And there was a privacy issue rather than anything else. But again, as you may be right, maybe not, I'm not sure. I'm
So,
also not
the,
that much
so
aware of it.
again, maybe I'm not that up to date on my company law. I've studied the previous version of company law, 1956, that was replaced by 2013 Act. But I believe when things are there for vote, anyone can go to the company and by paying a fee can get the full list of all shareholders. And we have done this
Okay.
in the past. And the reason for that is, you can send a tender offer or whatever. So, I don't know how it works. Maybe it's a good point. I'll check it out. But even if you own 100 shares in a company, you can go to the company secretary of the company and say, this is the fee that is prescribed under company law. And I want a list of all shareholders with their postal address and their number of shares that they own. Because let's say I want to launch a hostile takeover. How will I send my offer to all of those shareholders saying tender the shares? Or I want to pass an extraordinary resolution for sacking of the managing director.
Good
So
point.
I believe there are these provisions where anybody can access the list of shareholders and their addresses and stuff
Okay,
like that.
fair point. See, I myself don't know much about this particular legal side of things, so I just wanted to take your view on this. With that, I personally know your viewpoints on passive investments and why there is a case for active investing. So sure, for larger audiences, it might be a good idea to do passive. But there is also a case for active investing, right? And one big reason is how the index are constituted. We have seen 2007 infra companies and real estate companies becoming a large chunk, in 2000s tech companies becoming a large chunk of index. So you tend to own the most non-ownable sectors at that point in time when you are in index. So rather than, taking your view on passive, which is a very known view, I want to probably question you on, let's say if you want to construct, let's say tomorrow you have been given a responsibility to construct a good index, okay? How would you make it beneficial for a shareholder, for a retail audience? Sure, it will go against all the incentives. You have to be an active manager, but if you do have to do that, what will you do? How would a good index look like in your understanding?
Wouldn't be very different from the way things are constructed currently. So I don't have a very good solution for a very vast improvement. Among the few things that I would try and do is to safeguard things. One is I would be more cautious about sectoral concentrations. So despite market cap weighting, not to have too much weightage to a particular sector, just like we have in the funds. This is relatively easy to do in a country like India, but let's say if you were trying to create an index for Saudi Arabian stock market, you can't cap weightage of Saudi Aramco and say you can't have maximum more than 10% in Saudi Aramco because market structure is like that. And again,
Sure.
I don't know how things would work in the US where, let's say, all these big tech companies are very, very large and things like that. But I would try and cap exposure per sector. I would have a cooling period of some time before a company comes into the index after listing. So that would be something I would consider.
So just to understand that, you're saying when a company is listed, it should not be directly listing into an index. Is that what you're
Yeah,
saying?
or not even in next 1 month, 2 months. I
Okay.
have a criteria, maybe a company should be there as a listed company for 2 years before
Okay.
it starts getting the passive
Interesting.
flows.
Fair point. Okay. And a related question then to that is that, what in your view is a So there's a very common belief system that majority of active fund managers don't beat indices, at least in the developed market, in US, etc. We all know about Buffett's bet, and you know, he loves to quote it every time in the shareholder meeting. But that's not really the case in Indian markets. The active investors have done better than, and a lot of active investors have done better than the indices. Where do you think that edge comes from, if not the constituent of index itself? So if the index itself has limitations, then it's a different matter. But if the index cannot be improved that much, where does that edge come for Indian active managers compared to, let's say, developed market active managers?
Sure. So again, I'm not too ideological about this. So I believe that anyone who has zero knowledge and zero time and inclination to do even a basic hygiene check can simply go and buy a Nifty fund rather than not have any exposure to equity. Just buy Nifty index funds and be done with it. So no harm in index investing. At the same time, there are people at the other extreme who say index funds are nothing and all other active managers are equivalent to criminals or something like that. So I'm not in that camp also. So this number gets thrown about quite a bit. This percentage of fund managers did not manage to beat the index. Now, what people fail to realize is index is a artificial construct. What one can compare it with is, you can compare it with index funds on a like-to-like basis rather than comparing with index. So just in jest, not to be too serious about it, let's say 75% of fund managers fail to beat the index, but 100% of the index funds fail to beat the index, because there would be some expense ratio attached to the index, right? So there was a study recently and huge noise on social media where they were comparing regular plans of mutual funds with the index, not even index funds, where obviously if you load the client servicing cost, the record keeping cost and everything, then it's not apple to apple comparison. Now, if you are looking at an ETF, then you need to have a brokerage account, you need to pay your DMAT fees, you need to pay your brokerage and STT to even get those ETF units in your DMAT account. So one has to be fair both ways. In terms of how can you, what is the edge, or how to go about trying to do better than the indices? First is, take all the advantages of passive investing and incorporate it in your strategy. So what are those advantages? One is, be mindful of costs. So you can't run a 2 and 20 kind of fund, which is only benefiting the people managing it and which is looting the end investor. Be mindful of cost. Be mindful of taxes. Don't take unnecessary churn, which results in taxes for the end client, especially if you are managing direct stocks. Third is, have systems in place. The advantage of indices is that they are systematic, rule-based, and don't have human biases built in. So in your own investment team, investment process, make sure that you don't fall prey to biases and there is some system to the whole approach that you have. And finally, try and identify the clear flaws that are there in the way indices and index funds are run and take advantage of them. So one thing that people do is they front run all these index funds. So the changes are known in advance. You know, on this particular date, this much quantity will be bought and sold, which is public information. People buy and sell in anticipation and the funds are not able to do it. Again, there are some, there is this whole parlor game of which stock will come in and which stock will move out based on market cap or free float and all that kind of thing. But I am talking about very, very basic things. So the entire world knew that HDFC Limited and HDFC Bank is merging. The entire world knew that the exchange ratio, this is going to be the exchange ratio. Still, there was a, for the longest period of time, maybe a 4% price differential between the two or 5%. You could, if you were owning HDFC Bank, you could sell that and buy HDFC Limited and pocket that difference. But an index fund cannot do that. Now, everyone knows that Tata Motors and Tata Motor DVR, if you own Tata Motors, you should probably sell that and buy the DVR. But an index fund will not be able to do that. Now, an individual investor will have tax considerations or other transaction cost considerations and all that. So, people running active funds professionally should try and figure out what are the disadvantages that plague passive funds and benefit from those.
Fair point. Hi friends, I hope you're enjoying this particular episode. I just want to take a minute and thanks the sponsors for this episode. Stoic Talks was built on a premise of actionable insights and detailed questioning, and that usually requires the independence of doing that work. When you're looking for somebody to partner with, you are not only looking for somebody who will share your ethos, but also will promote this independence of asking fearless questions without any hesitations. So when we were looking for someone like that, the obvious first choice for me was a DSP mutual fund. I have known their team. I have worked with them for a long period of time. You know, they have this tagline called hashtag invest for good, which I really like because it really associates, which in my observation, I've seen them living this as the way of their life, and which is very visible. If you follow their work in public, they have done some excellent research efforts. They've come up with some amazing reports, which everybody enjoys reading. For example, they have this report called Netra. Then there is the transcript, which talks about the conf call transcripts. Then there is the annual report, Nectar, the Navigator, and many such reports, which I enjoy reading and is enjoyed by many practitioners in the investment community. So we are extremely proud to be working with such a team. They completely agree with our vision for Stoic Talks, and I really want to thank them for supporting this particular episode. And if you aren't already, I would highly recommend you to follow them on Twitter. With their Twitter ID is @DSPMF. So thanks once again and enjoy listening to this show. Rajiv, I think the last October Quest, you gave a talk on factor investing. You recommended some books also on factor investing. I myself practice it a lot. I'm data centric in my investments, and I'll probably borrow your understanding, but before that, let me question mine. And the way I see factor investing is that it is common sense investing converted into quantitative boundaries, so to speak. So as a value investor, we look for quality, they convert it into, let's say, a quality factor. We look for growth, it becomes a growth factor. So all the moving parts that has a probabilistic role in moving a stock up has been converted into factors. What has been your learnings? You have been reading a lot on factor investing, as you told there in October Quest. And has it become a part of your investment in portfolios in any way, or is it still an experimentation phase? What's your learning around this factor investing world?
So let's talk about value factor first, to begin with. Now, value factor, people will have different implementations on that. Some people will take price to book or book to market as value literature, or the academic literature takes it, book to market, or reverse of price to book, or some people will take a earnings based measure and things like that. Now, you clearly know that buying cheap works based on intuitive sense as well as academic literature, but there could be pitfalls. So earnings could be manipulated, or book value could be manipulated, especially in financial stocks. If you have not provided for bad loans, you could have some discretionary expenditures, things like brand building or entering a new geography, which are not completely reflected in the reported earnings, and because of which a stock could be optically expensive but actually cheap. So there are these outliers, or there would be some systemic errors when you apply it as a completely academic, mechanical, factor-based approach. The way we implement it is, we run two kinds of screens, and we have monthly meetings around this. One is our own portfolios. We look at what are the factor scores based on whatever factors we have identified. How is our portfolio ranking? So that is one. And secondly, for our coverage universe, what are the high ranking factor portfolios that the quant screens are running? And is there something that we are missing out? If we don't own something, and if it's ranking very well on quantitative screens, is there a need to take a deeper look? So it's like taking your blood test. Now, just one parameter doesn't mean you will change your medication or you will do some drastic action. But maybe if your cholesterol level is too high or some ratio is bad, maybe you should get a stress test done, or maybe you should get an angiography done. So it's a starting point. If we own 20 stocks and two of those stocks are ranking very bad in all the quantitative screens, value, quality, low vol, momentum, everything is terrible. Now, the question is, we are owning this. When was the last time we have looked at this? Have we missed out something? Do we need to talk to some sell side analysts who have a different opinion on this? Do we need to recheck our numbers? So it's a starting point. It's not that we have given up the portfolio construction to a machine, but it's an additional tool.
So it's an additional vantage point for you to question your holdings in some way. If it's contradicting, maybe you need to ask a bit more detail. Fair enough. But sir, one thing which I also observed, and this is purely if you want, I can share some things, is also that the academic literature that exists on a very large US data frame. The moment we try to take that literature and test it in the Indian markets, there are a lot of things that come out here which are very different from the academic literature. And I'm bringing this, it just struck me because you said value factor. And I did a work for 20 years, value factor performances. And surprisingly, the lower quartile value factors are not really as high performing as they are in US markets. And sure, there could be reasons for it. And one very common reason we know is that majority of those low ones are the asset bargains and activism being missing and all that kind of stuff. So in your experience, when you test those, or if you test those academic literatures, have you found discrepancies in anything, or it's a nascent thing and you're just experimenting with this, whatever your current viewpoint is?
So there are many pitfalls to the way the
factors are constructed.
So, for example, there's this book called Blitzscaling, which is relevant for startups, not so much for mature companies, but maybe one of mature companies could also benefit from what is said over there. So the point being, if it's a winner takes all kind of market, what matters is not your reported P&L. What matters is, are you gaining market share and are you going to be the dominant player? And sure, do you have enough sustaining power to make the other players irrelevant? Now, if that is happening, the value factor will screen that thing as very poorly, but probably it makes a good buy case. Now, there could be monopoly businesses, duopoly businesses around where this kind of a dichotomy is there. It was very interesting. Again, without getting into the name of the stock, so Sanjay Bhattacharya was talking about a stock at the CFA event in Delhi, and there are other, and he was negative on the company, and there are other very renowned investors who have invested in the company, where again, there are not much of reported profits, but you could make a bull case, you could make a bear case for the same stock. And the academic value factor will not help or will rank it poorly, surely.
Sure.
So brand expenses, patents, R&D expenses, monopoly businesses where market share changes are taking place, leverage, all these things will not come across properly in a academic value factor. So
my thinking is that you
can just screen for those and see if you are missing something.
Yeah, I personally feel there's a lot of scope of improvement in this factor thinking itself. But anyways, that could be a very long discussion. You know, so maybe a couple more questions if you have time, if you don't mind. One is, since you read a lot and the world keeps on changing, any thoughts or any incremental understanding on the new asset class that has been created in the last few years of the decentralized finance world, crypto world? It's just fascinating to read about it, but as a asset manager who focuses on cash flow, it's difficult to wrap your head around it. How are you thinking about this, if at all, and any views on it if you have?
Sure. So I've done quite a bit of reading and thinking about this. So the whole thing about NFTs and the whole thing about decentralized finance and smart contracts, I think is too much hype. I don't think there's much to it. As a store of, and again, will these be as convenient as using UPI for your day-to-day transactions? I don't think the inherent technology is like that for the Bitcoin or Ethereum or things like that. But as a store of value, like if everyone says a Bitcoin should be worth $50,000 or $75,000 or maybe $1 million, who are we to say that there is a finite supply and the price will be what the buyer and seller determine? So because of scarcity and because of central banks printing so much money, could it be seen as store of value? Who knows? Just as an anecdote, so I'd gone to Turkey recently, which saw 70% kind of inflation in the last year. Over there, people will accept Turkish lira for day-to-day transactions, but they will try and convert that to euros almost immediately. If they are expecting to store it for a month or two, they will not keep it in the form of Turkish lira in their wallet or in their bank accounts probably. And I actually saw in Istanbul, on a street called Istiklal Street, there was a shop which was offering to convert Turkish lira to Bitcoin and vice versa. And we are reading about Argentina and the very high inflation over there. So if central banks don't keep a lid on inflation, then could people start looking at these kind of things as a store of value? Who knows? And again, another thing, so far the world's reserve currency has been the US dollar. Now in this Russia-Ukraine war, US has tried to weaponize the financial system and trying to seize assets of Russia and things like that. Now, who's to say if people get fed up with all this, and there could be a case for all these crypto things. But the flip side to this is what Munger said about finite supply. Bitcoin supply is limited, but can you create another cryptocurrency out of thin air? Yes. If another 10 people come together and create a Puneet coin, that's a new cryptocurrency. So there are infinite number of new currencies that could be created.
It has played out that journey also. I mean, the last couple of years only we have seen so many of them.
As long as you own a business which provides a valuable product or a service with pricing power, no matter what the currency, that business would be valuable. So I try to focus more on that piece.
Sure. So, Rajiv, you know, whenever I talk to you, there is inherently, I can't help it, but I always think of Farag Bhai. I met him in 2011, I remember. And one thing that 2011, there was a Delhi investor sort of get together where Parag Bhai and Professor Bakshi actually invited him. And that was the first time I heard him. And what struck me was that he had this amazing clarity of ambiguity. You know, he probably understood why some things are ambiguous in nature and they will always remain ambiguous. And it was a brilliant learning. I get a very similar feeling from you, and I'm pretty sure that Parag Bhai would be extremely proud of what direction PPFA has taken. His legacy has multifold, and all thanks to you, Neil, and you know, your entire team, Ronak and everybody else. So, and thank you for imparting this wisdom. I'll always love to talk to you. It was a great honor to have this conversation again, and I would probably love to host you again if I have more questions. But thank you so much for your time. Thank you for agreeing to do this, and lovely talking to you.
Thanks a lot, Puneet. Thank you so much for the kind words. Always a pleasure.
Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully.